we know that after 15 years, people who commit sex offenses desist.
That's ridiculous.
It's not
that
ridiculous.
That is so untrue.
That's not true.
There's disharmony.
Okay, wait, please.
They don't age out.
A meta-analysis of 21 studies by Carl Hansen showed across the board there is desistance, even for the highest risk. The lowest risk right away have a 1 to 5% chance of recidivism. I'm not assuming. It's a meta-analysis. I didn't do it. It's by Carl Hansen. It was published in 2014.
Welcome to the SOA Forum. We're a monthly debate series that features topics of special interest to libertarians and aims to enhance social and professional ties within New York City's libertarian community. This is an Oxford-style debate in which the audience initially votes for, against, or undecided on the resolution, and then again after the debate is over. Whoever moves the debate in his or her favor is declared the winner. Go into SoHoVote.com, SoHoVote.com, to cast your initial vote. You'll find that tonight's resolution reads, all the laws requiring those convicted of sex offenses to put their names in a registry should be abolished. We're partners with Reason Magazine in presenting these debates, and you can catch audio of all our events on the Reason podcast, which you'll find on the iTunes store. Thanks also to the Smith Family Foundation for making this series possible. For more information and to buy tickets to our future debates, go to our website at thesohoforum.org. I'm Gene Epstein, director of the SOHO Forum. Arguing for the affirmative on the resolution, we have sociologist Emily Horowitz, author of Protecting Our Kids, How Sex Offender Laws Are Failing Us. Emily, please come to the stage. Opposing the resolution, we have Marcy Hamilton, author of Justice Denied, What America Must Do to Protect Its Children. Marcy, please come to the stage. Jane, please close the initial vote. Emily Horowitz, please take the podium and give us your defense of the resolution. Take it away, Emily.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you, Jean. Thank you, Jane. Thank you, everyone at the SOHO Forum. Thank you, Reason, for sponsoring this debate and taking on this challenging and emotional topic. First, some caveats. This is a very complicated issue, one that puts our emotions at war with our heads and with the facts. Second, this is really, to me, about the world we want for ourselves and our children. How do we reckon with wrongdoing as well as the injury and trauma that people suffer from sex offenses? Do we want accountability and reasonable punishment, or do we want to go further and have laws that stigmatize and label people forever? Tonight, I'd like to do a few things. First, I'm going to give the basics of sex offense registries, what led to registration laws in every state, and what the supporters of these laws were saying. And then I'll explain how these laws have failed and why more and more people are questioning whether registries are needed. I'll be going against the grain. After several decades, there's a huge public support for registries. However, as a sociologist and a criminologist, years of work have convinced me that registries are very problematic. I hope that we all agree, I think Marcy and I definitely agree on this, that public safety is a priority. There must be effective efforts to lower and prevent sex offenses and ensure accountability when they do happen. There's a very important controversy about the facts that I want to make sure you know about. Many people believe, I'm sure many people in this room believe, that individuals who commit sex offenses will not stop, they can't stop, they will go on to reoffend. This is false. Years ago, however, the U.S. Supreme Court picked up that falsehood, declaring in several landmark cases that the recidivism rate in sex offenses is, quote, frightening and high. This line, that the recidivism rate for sex offenses is, quote, frightening and high, went into hundreds of other court decisions and infected an entire area of law and policy. After many futile corrections efforts, the dam finally burst in 2015. An investigatory piece in a peer-reviewed law journal revealed the words came from a therapist who was quoted in a news magazine with no research or evidence to back up the claim. Federal and state courts use this falsehood to rubber stamp all kinds of terrible laws based on this wildly exaggerated fear of reoffense. The truth is, the reoffense rate is about the lowest of any category of offender. Fortunately, this controversy has gotten media coverage. Radley Balco in the Washington Post covered this. His piece was headlined, "The Big Lie About Sex Offenders." A New York Times piece was titled, "When Junk Science About Sex Offenders Infects the Supreme Court." Undoing the damage is a huge job, but has already begun. Keep in mind that registration laws are based on fear, not on evidence. Until I met somebody who was on the registry, I, like most of you, had never given registries a second thought. Since 1996, we've had registration laws in all 50 states. These laws vary, but each state has a list of offenses that require registration. Those lists of registrable offenses are getting longer. That's how people end up on the registry. What you have to do when you're on the registry, you have to visit an office regularly. You have to have your photo taken. You have to give an update. A lot of personal information, your home address, age, height, weight, offense, school, and even your work address. Simply missing a deadline for registration can result in a felony charge in prison. This personal info goes onto the registry website, which we've all seen. It's available to anyone 24/7. It's searchable by name, address, zip code, anything you want. Some states go further with community notification. They mail postcards to neighbors, they post flyers, they issue press releases, they install yard signs. Some states, your driver's license is stamped with sex offender in bold letters. The information on these websites gets picked up and redistributed by private companies. Media outlets, such as the local patch websites, regularly publish maps with dots to signify where registrants live. For anyone on the registry, there are other laws to worry about. Local and state laws in many states restrict where one can live, work, and visit. Registrants are often required to undergo scientifically unreliable polygraph testing and electronic monitoring. 9 states have castration laws for sex offenses. We have extra punishment for sex offenses. These are a special set of laws that apply to people after they've already paid their price, after they've experienced the harsh realities of jail, prison, probation, and parole. California's registry was the first registry. It started in 1947. It tracked gays and communists. Decades later, in the 1990s, several terrible crimes against children had lawmakers around the country scrambling to enact registry statutes. The laws bear their names: Jacob Wetterling, Adam Walsh, Megan Kanka, Drew Shodine. These crimes were rare, but the fear and anger raged. Stranger danger became a thing and dramatically changed the way we raise our children. The specter of these awful cases remains so powerful that there's support for just about any law that will protect the children. Nearly 900,000 people are in registries, and the number keeps rising. Over 40,000 in New York, mostly men, some women. Every age from minors to seniors. A wide range of offenses: consensual teen sex, sexting, paying for sex, possession of erotic images of anyone under 18, even with no evidence of any contact offenses, public urination, and forcible offenses. There's evidence that African American men are landing on the registry far more often than white men. I recently edited a book about the rash of intellectually and developmentally disabled people who wind up on the registry. Several million people are directly impacted when family members are included. The argument for registry laws is summed up in the one phrase, protect the children. Proponents argued that listing offenders and their whereabouts would keep the public safer. When Clinton signed Megan's Law in 1996, he said, "There is no greater right than a parent's right to raise a child in safety and love. Today, America circles the wagons around our children." But has it worked? After 20 years of registry, what do we know? First, the research. Little research back then, but a lot has accumulated. Public safety. There's no rigorous evidence that the registry improves public safety. Recidivism, there's no rigorous evidence that the registry reduces recidivism. Cost, figures are hard to come by, but the registry costs federal and state tax dollars, very likely several hundred million dollars annually. Human impacts, the two words, sex offender, carry more punch than just about any phrase. For those who must sign the registry, the impacts are wide and severe, described as social death by many commentators. Here are some field reports. 2 registrants were murdered. The man convicted of their killing had found them on a registry website, and after his sentencing, he said, they deserve to die. He said he would have killed more if he hadn't been caught. In Texas, a talented computer scientist with a sex offense history came out of prison, completed his PhD, and got an offer from a Silicon Valley firm. After the usual checks, the offer was withdrawn, and he works in a coffee shop, the only job he can find. In Grand Rapids, Michigan, a registrant froze to death on the street in the winter. By law, two homeless shelters were unable to give him warmth because both facilities were too close to schools. A graduate student hoping to find a date online instead got talked into a sting and spent time in prison. After 2 years of fruitless job hunting, he made a decision. He left the country permanently. If our concern is children, stranger danger is wildly exaggerated. 90% of sexual offenses against children and teens are committed by someone they know, often a family member. And almost all the time, that person is not on the registry, but a first-time offender. Child sexual abuse is complex. It doesn't fit the stereotype of a much older perpetrator. About one-third to one-quarter of those who sexually abuse children are other children and teens. Among adult perpetrators, young adults under the age of 30 are overrepresented. But what matters most, for all the energy put into registries and punishments, sex crimes against children have been declining for decades, starting before the implementation of the registry. For years, courts have upheld registry laws. The judicial ground is starting to shift, and several recent decisions give a glimmer. A tough federal appeals court judge wrote in an opinion that the Michigan registry, quote, creates social lepers. Reflecting on the dangers of registries, another federal judge said Colorado's Registration Act poses a, quote, serious threat of retaliation, violence, ostracism, shaming, and other unfair and irrational treatment from the public. Massachusetts' top court overturned restrictions on where registrants can live and referenced WW2 internments. She said, the days are long since past when communities of persons, such as Native Americans and Japanese Americans, may be lawfully banished from our midst. So the registry doesn't improve public safety or decrease recidivism, and it costs a lot of money and has negative impacts on the lives of registrants and their families. What would happen without it? Every state has a raft of criminal statutes, as does the federal government. Any concern over reoffense is addressed with additional penalties. Patty Wetterling's son, Jacob, was abducted, molested, and killed. She campaigned energetically for registries. The Jacob Wetterling Act memorializes her son. Since then, her thinking has changed. Here's what Patty says now. I based my support on my assumption that sex offenders have the highest recidivism rate of any criminal. But the high recidivism rates I assume to be true do not exist. It has made me rethink the value of broad-based community notification laws, which operate on the assumption that most sex offenders are high-risk dangers to the community they are released to. What we really want is no more victims. Don't do it again. So how can we get there? Locking them up forever, labeling them, and not allowing them community support doesn't work. I've turned 180 degrees from where I was. If the mother of a murdered child can reject registries, so can we. The registry is broken. It's time to replace it with measures that actually protect our communities. Thank you.
Marcy, thank you. Thank you. Marcy Hamilton speaking for the negative on the resolution. Take it away, Marcy.
Thanks to Jean and the SoHo Forum. It is comforting to know that in this divisive era that it's possible for people to have a civil debate, even about very heated issues, which of course, child sex abuse is one of them. I actually feel sorry for my opponent in this debate in some ways. It's very hard to argue against recidivism when Larry Nassar just went to prison after 156 women testified against him in court. 265 have charged him with civil litigation. That's hundreds. But he's not by himself. In my experience through Child USA and my work on statutes of limitations, when one victim comes forward, frequently, typically, many come after. Now, I'm actually going to agree on one point. I think that the perpetrators that are under 18 deserve treatment. Not labeling. They're the ones that the science shows can actually turn the corner. They're the ones whose lives can be most ruined. I will also agree that we should have a Romeo and Juliet exception. If someone is 2 or 3 years apart from the person with whom they've had sex, it's highly unlikely that it is a sex offense. But for everybody else, Sex offender registries are just one of the tools we need to stop the pandemic of child sex abuse. The vast majority of abuse is by individuals that are known to the victim. They are in the family, their coaches, their Boy Scout leaders, their priests, their rabbis. The stranger danger that we just heard about is just largely a myth. It's the people in these children's lives who prey on the children. And how do we know who is going to prey on a child? From one of the most informative speeches I've ever heard from FBI expert on child sex abuse, Ken Lanning, at Cardozo Law School at a symposium that I organized immediately after the Boston Globe stories came out about abuse there, he said the following. He said, you know who normally sexually abuses children? The nice guy. The one that's got everybody's trust. The one that has the capacity to get access. And who are they? They are the people who choose jobs to have access to many children. They are priests. They are rabbis. They are teachers. They are coaches. They are the people we love. And then he added, and by the way, they really are nice. Like, they're really nice people. It just so happens that they victimize children. Children cannot defend themselves against these individuals. It is very rare for there to be a false claim about child sex abuse. This has been confirmed by study after study, by the emerging studies that are being done by child traumatologists, like the top people in the country at Yale, at the University of Pennsylvania, where I work with Dr. Stephen Berkowitz. What we're dealing with here, trying to get rid of these registries, is what is at the base of what's at fault in our culture. It's the reason our children are at risk. Adults prefer and they protect adults. Adult interests are always so much more important than children. Children don't vote. They don't have lobbies. They don't matter. But in fact, they deserve our protection. And the registries for those over 18 are just one of the ways that we are trying to get control of a problem that is harming too many children. One in four girls and one in six boys will be sexually abused by the time they're 18. That is a statistic that is confirmed again and again and again by studies and by looking at the relevant literature. What we're talking about tonight, who's on a registry after all? You have to have either pled guilty or you have to have been convicted. And if you're convicted, you must have been convicted beyond a reasonable doubt. We're not talking about people who are walking down the street and someone says, you know what, I saw what you did with that child, so you know what, I'm going to put you on a registry. In fact, Ohio tried that kind of a registry, just a random civil registry. And in the state of Ohio, it turned out that you can't put someone on a sex abuse registry unless they're convicted through the criminal court system with all of its limitations on the ability to convict someone. These are people who are criminals. One of the arguments that is sometimes made in this arena is that how in the world could you put someone who just looks at child porn on a registry? That's not fair. They haven't hurt anybody. But if you look at the science, what the science tells us now is that child porn normalizes sexual abuse, the activity of abuse. It's not a side activity. It makes it easier for someone to be likely to seek out children. Today we have no effective permanent treatment for sex offenders. For those under 18 with the right treatment, there is hope. But for over 18, that treatment does not exist. And so what we are being persuaded of tonight is that we are supposed to feel sorry for people who have sexually assaulted children. And now other people know that they sexually assaulted children, and we're supposed to forget it, forgive them? That's not the job of the law. The job of the law is to protect the vulnerable. And the vulnerable will not be protected if, in fact, we don't do everything in our power to protect children. So how do we reduce the risk of child sex abuse? It's going to take this entire culture. If you watched the Nassar story, who let those children down? It was a major research university, Michigan State. It was a respected doctor, Dr. Larry Nassar. It was the Karolyi Ranch down in Texas. It was the U.S. Olympic Committee. It was USA Gymnastics, the National Governing Board for Gymnastics. And it was every other adult, every nurse, every therapist that didn't do the mandated reporting they should have done. That, in a nutshell, is the problem with our culture right now. We are perfectly capable of assuming that the man in power deserves our protection. God forbid we would take away his livelihood, even though child after child after child reports him. There are many, many lessons to be learned from the Nassar case, but one of them is not that this is unusual. This is how it happens. Second Mile at Penn State did not pay attention to the fact that they were supplying victims to Jerry Sandusky repeatedly. The Catholic Church has ignored, to this day, telling us the full list of all the people they know that have sexually abused many, many people. So what do we do in a very difficult era in which finally children have some kind of constitutional rights? They actually became persons in this century. We need to change the statutes of limitations and open up the door so that instead of worrying about whether the people who assaulted them are going to be happy in their lives, we'll give them the opportunity to come forward when they're ready rather than the culture. We need to improve mandatory reporting. We need to improve background checks. We need to improve the education of the public. We need to improve the empowerment of survivors. In fact, pedophiles don't age out. John Gagan, the priest in Boston, who was one of the first two to be named in the Catholic Church abuse scandal, was in his 80s when he was finally found out, and he was still abusing children. For each child sex abuse victim, we know from the studies that it costs about $210,000 extra over the course of their lives because they were abused, because they were victims of violent activity. So what do we want to do? We've got to prevent sex abuse. And the only way we will do that is by changing many laws. But one of the ones that we can't change yet, if ever, is the fact that if you are convicted of sexually assaulting a child, you need to be on the registry. Parents deserve to know who you are, and so do the institutions that will be sued if they hire the offender without knowing what's going on. Thank you.
Emily, take the podium. Your chance at a rebuttal.
So just get my folder. Okay, thank you, Marcy. So you brought up Nassar. That's a very emotionally charged and terrible case, but he wasn't on the registry. And most of the cases we're hearing about are not people who are on the registry. I agree with you. Our culture has to change. We've got to encourage kids to report. We've got to encourage parents to listen. But the registry is not the answer. The registry is for people who made a mistake. The registry is for people who've already gone to prison, who've already gone to jail. And there is lots and lots of evidence that after people are arrested, after people are punished, they do stop. That's why recidivism rates are very, very low, any way you look at it. But I really appreciate that we're having this conversation because too often these two sides are isolated and we don't communicate. But let's start where we agree. We all want children to be safe. We all want to reduce sexual assault and victimization. There's no evidence the registry does any of this. There's piles of evidence that show it doesn't improve public safety or reduce recidivism. It also gives people who rely on it a false sense of security. We've raised a generation of kids who can't use common sense to determine real danger versus fake danger, and this is one of the awful effects of the registry. Crime has never been lower, but parental anxiety has never been higher. Teens have sex. It's a fact, and criminalizing teens who have sex or sexed doesn't make us safer. Did we all in this room wait until we were legal age to have sex? I doubt it. As Lenore Skenazy here tonight noted in her recent Cato lecture, it's likely many of us have done things that would have landed us on the registry. Lots of bad things happen to children and adults, but we've elevated sexual wrongdoing and vengeance for sexual wrongdoing by saying protect the children, we've got to protect the children, to a level that's out of control. We have to ensure that children and everybody can ask for help and get it and have their pleas taken seriously. I'm a mother of four, including three girls. I want my girls, especially, to learn to be empowered, to have the confidence to say no. The recent outpouring of tales about sexual assault often note how women freeze. They can't talk. They can't fight back. They say, I froze. I don't know why I went up to his hotel room. I don't know why I didn't get out of the car. I went even though I knew I shouldn't. Many of the women we're hearing from weren't dragged into the woods by strangers and raped, but for reasons we need to examine, as you said, in our culture, about conditioning, about gender roles, many of these women are not saying no. Let's not banish people who commit sex offenses and ask them to succeed in a hostile environment. Let's fund programs that teach about the effects of sex abuse and the importance of reporting abuse so it can be stopped. Common sense and awareness, sexual education and prevention, as well as communication between parents and children, that's what decreases sexual violence. Not naming and shaming those who've already been named and shamed. By all measures, every measure we look at, child sexual abuse is declining. We've had a 62% decrease since 1990. In 1990, about a quarter of children reported abuse. That's up 50%. These laws are an invitation to discriminate, harass, and even physically attack registrants. People on the registry become suspects for life. If your driver's license says sex offender on it, that's an open invitation to profiling. This is just punishment for the sake of punishment, punishment on top of punishment. Remember, people with a conviction record already face nearly 50,000 federal, state, and local legal restrictions, collateral consequences. We don't need more. Let me underscore that one of the worst fears that people have about sex offenses, that the people who commit them will not stop. All the research says that's not true. Here's my key point. People who are arrested for a sex offense are less likely to be rearrested than any other type of offender. Decades of research shows us this fact. Recidivism is a non-issue. It's confusing to talk about, but it's the exact opposite of what the Supreme Court claimed. Very rigorous studies have shown us this. In the end, we all want the same thing, not punishment for the sake of punishment. In Florida, a man works all day, eats dinner with his family at home, then he goes to sleep in a parking lot. Why? Because his home with his family is too near a school. We need policies based on evidence, based on facts, not fears. We need accountability without destruction and real ways to reduce sexual harm. We need a society where people are allowed to change and redeem themselves, where victims and offenders get counseling and support in prison and out. We want to ease the burden on victims reporting abuse. When people aren't figured, a society where people are not fingered or registered for things they might do. People do terrible things to each other, even to children, but the registry is not the tool to fix it.
Rebuttal from Marcy. Take it away, Marcy.
Well, so then let's go to the studies that actually are accurate. What the research shows is that, in fact, and if you talk to the FBI, who are the ones who are experts in this arena, many of these perpetrators have over 150 victims over the course of their lives. That is recidivism. That's scary recidivism. What Emily is telling you is that there is less recidivism among sex offenders than there is compared to B&E. That's ridiculous. Recidivism means that the perpetrator gets more than one child. I have to tell you, the thousands of victims that I've worked with over the course of my career, I don't remember any that just had one victim. And I'm including every family. I don't remember one. You know why? Because there weren't any. So the notion that we don't have to worry about these people and we have to worry, just make sure that we protect them is once again what I said earlier. We prefer and we protect our adults. And we don't really care about kids if we can shove them over to the side. If Nassar had been found out earlier, he would have been on a sex offender registry, and instead of 265 victims who have come forward so far, we might have two. So the fact that he's not on a sex offender registry just shows the system is broken, not that sex offender registries don't work. In fact, we do have a study. There's a study out of Washington State that shows that with a registration system, recidivism dropped. Before the registration, recidivism was a certain level. After, it dropped. There's another group that is studying the same thing in New York. They're finding the same result. In fact, registration has some kind of deterrent value. And if it saves one child from child sex abuse, which can destroy that child's life and all of their families, then it seems to me that we're talking about the right thing in terms of having registration. But let me just close by saying I've never heard anything like the statement that, in a kind of condescending tone, that kids can't tell the difference between real danger and fake danger. Hello? We're talking about child sex abuse. Kids can't tell that this perpetrator is grooming them, is using them to get what that perpetrator wants. So it's true, they can't tell. And that's why they're at risk. And that's why adults need the registry to know who to keep their children from. Thank you.
Thank you, Marcy. The debaters have decided to waive the right to ask each other questions. So start thinking about questions that you want to ask. And I tell both debaters, please grab the mic that you've got, and don't hold it that close to your mouth, but do hold it close enough to talk. Before we turn it over to audience questions, I'm sure you'll have a good many good ones. I want to take moderator's prerogative to ask a question of my own while also finding out what kind of questions are coming in from the virtual space. My first question, just one question to each of the debaters. Emily, Marcy has stipulated, that she would waive all sex offender registries for the Romeo and Juliet cases. Essentially, she
not,
would
focus. Not Romeo and Juliet cases, minors, right?
Minors, yes, right. Essentially, it would be only for those over 18. Could you define what you mean? First, could you define what you mean by recidivism? And then second, can you affirm that those over 18, those category of sex offenders, that their recidivism rate is no higher than the recidivism rate for other felonies? So first, what is recidivism in your view, and is it no higher for that population that Marcy has stipulated she herself would focus on?
Well, the vast studies of recidivism rates that I'm talking
about. Mike.
Sorry, is it on? Okay. Mike. So recidivism rates that I'm talking about are being rearrested and reconvicted for another sex offense. And a meta-analysis in 2014 of 21 of the most rigorous studies found the recidivism rates were very low for all types of sex offenses.
Including those over 18?
Yes. Okay. The majority of, yes, including those over 18.
No higher than for other felonies?
Lower than for any other category of crime that we track. And it's great that you think minors shouldn't be on registries. However, when the laws were passed in 1996, minors were not on the registries. And then child advocates fought to get minors on the registries. In 1996, minors were not on them. In 2006, the Adam Walsh Act put them on them, which is why we have to start over. When you have a law that people want to make it tougher and tougher and tougher. So we added minors after 10 years of evidence that the laws weren't working.
Thank you, Emily. My one question for Marcy. Marcy, we have other felonies that have many hundreds of victims. We have muggers. Muggers have had hundreds of victims. We have second-degree murderers. We have arsonists who threaten children. We have burglars. Would you, if you say better to have registries to save the life of one child, would you want to have registries for all of these felonies given your concern that arsonists might kill children through burning, that muggers might kill children, all of them having multiple offenders, would you want to have registries for all of these felons as well?
The reason that, is this on?
Yeah.
The reason that the registry is particularly important in child sex abuse arena is because of the way that perpetrators operate. They operate in a universe where children don't see what's coming. They can't see what's coming. They're either being groomed or they're being loved. And so they cannot figure out that they need to protect themselves. Every crime you've just mentioned is a crime of violence that it is possible that you might be able to figure out if someone's coming at you with this problem.
You think a child knows a mugger is coming or the arsonist is coming?
A child definitely doesn't know that sexual assault is coming.
Well, what about arson or mugging or burglary?
They're not on the same plane. They're completely different.
Don't
crimes.
Arsonists kill children too? No, no.
You tell me. I don't
well,
know
I believe
statistics.
So, yeah. They burn houses down where children live. Okay, anyway, you've answered the question, and I followed up. We want to throw it over to questions from the audience. Do I see a first question? Please phrase your question as a question, take it away, the first questioner.
Yeah, thanks. The sex registry just tells people what your address and workplace are and so forth, but it doesn't tell you whether the person next to you in the subway is a sex offender or the person sitting next to you here tonight is a sex offender. Years ago, the Massachusetts Bay Colony solved this problem by requiring sex offenders for life to wear a scarlet letter identifying their sex crime.
And what is your question?
Do you think that we should endorse adopt such a policy? Hester Prynne got a letter A for her sex crime of adultery. Do you think the sex registry should be expanded to have some visible mark on sex offenders so that you can spot them in
on
a crowd?
Subway? So that you can spot them on a subway. So the question was, should sex offenders have markers so they can be spotted on subway?
I would say absolutely not.
No?
Yeah.
Surprising answer from Marcy, Emily Horace. Absolutely not. Marcy, your opinion about the subway question?
That's probably unconstitutional, actually. Oh. I think you've got a problem with that. Sex offender registries aren't.
Well,
sorry.
I have a question.
Yes.
I have a question from the virtual space. The Constitution prohibits cruel and unusual punishment, and also the Fifth Amendment says no person shall be subject to the same offense twice. Would you say that? Question for you, Marcy. Would you say that that sex offender registries are cruel and unusual punishment, or that they violate the Fifth Amendment?
Along with the courts that have been addressing these issues, no, they're not. Mm-hmm. But once again, child sex abuse is different. It's a different crime. It's so insidious. This is just one of the tools we need. It's just one of them. We're doing a terrible job. We're not finding the pedophiles where they are. We're not learning what we need to learn. So for the time being, this is one of the tools. Is it perfect? Are any of the tools perfect? No. But as between protecting the child and worrying about the sex offender who has been convicted of sexually assaulting a child, I'm inclined to protect the child.
Any comment from you, Emily, or do you want to?
I would just say, why not take all the millions and millions of dollars that we're spending on registries and find things that work and fund prevention programs and other programs to help prevent this instead of excess punishment?
Well, one way to prevent is to know who the pedophiles are.
But the data shows it doesn't prevent. The data
data does not show that.
Yes, Megan's Law was passed in 1996 in New Jersey. In New Jersey, the rate of sex offenses was declining 10 years before, it continued to decline. There was no difference before and after the implementation of Megan's Law in New York. There was no difference before and after the implementation of Megan's Law in New York.
That is a total red herring. It's true. Sex offenses against children in the quantum have been declining. That is true. What hasn't changed is the MO of the person who is going after the child. And the MO is, make sure that you get everybody around you to trust you so you can get as many as possible. It is laughable to think that we now know, one, how many children any sex offender on the registry has actually abused, and two, that we know enough that we don't really need to worry about this anymore. Children are being sexually assaulted every day by adults in a culture that doesn't care about children. This is just one tool.
Very much. Next question from the audience.
I think that a lot of people would agree that somebody who molests a five-year-old child is just a terrible person and should be treated horribly. But I get the impression that one can get on these registries for crimes like public urination when you just couldn't find a restroom and really had to go, or, you know, consensual sex between two adults who are camping in the woods out in the open, and some jerk takes a picture of them and turns them in, and it's indecent exposure, and now they're sex criminals for life, and they're on this registry, and they can't go near within hundreds of yards of a school, and they can't get a job, and their lives are ruined. Is this really appropriate?
I guess question for you, Marcy, would urination in public places, is that a sex offense?
If it's on a child.
On a child. But not if it's, not if you're peeing
Isn't
in the back of a wall,
about?
Say. Okay. Okay. I guess we know what your answer to that, Emily, is. So we'll pass on you. Question from the virtual space. Question from a gentleman who wants to identify himself as Stephen Shiro in the virtual space. Whatever happened to prison as paying your debt to society? What other crimes are treated this way? Murderers don't have a registry. Arsonists don't. Muggers don't. Provided offenders released from prison indicates they're no longer threats to society. What justifies placing them on lists as if they still are? It's either one or the other, no. Well, thank you. Stephen, could you cope with that question, Marcy? Paying your debt to society, whatever happened to that? For muggers and murderers and rapists and arsonists, rather, they pay their debt, but not sex offenders.
I think we have to go back to the foundation. What is the purpose of a sex offender registry about children who've been sexually assaulted? It's to keep more children from being assaulted. You can make all the arguments you want about these other crimes. Knock yourselves out. We're talking about whether or not we're going to try to keep children safe from a danger that we're having a really hard time identifying. Nassar is not an unusual case. It's just a much more public case. What you know about with Nassar is that every adult in that universe let those kids be abused, whether they understood it or not. That is true about the sex assaults I can tell you about families, right? That's true about the sex assaults that go on in the Boy Scouts. That's true about the sex assaults in the ultra-Orthodox community. It just is the reality. So while I find it fascinating as an academic, should we think about maybe having a murder registry? That's beside the point. The question here is, what are the best ways to protect children from pedophiles? And can we do it? And is this ever useful? And the answer is yes, it is.
Well, I mean, can I just
Emily,
say one thing about...
Emily wants to comment.
I just want to say Nassar committed those crimes in the context of a registry, in the context of the harshest sex offense policies on earth. No other country has policies like this. They're not effective. They're not working. I'm not here arguing in favor of child sex abuse. Nobody is. Everybody wants to protect the children. I disagree. I think everybody wants to protect children from danger, and that's a primary goal that's driving all of these laws. But I'm here talking about justice. These are people who go to prison. Prison in the United States is a really hard place. Parole, probation, there's many, many consequences once you're caught and convicted. And if we don't give these people a second chance, what does it mean to even be human? It's a terrible way of looking at society and humanity.
Well, and for the sex assault victim, they kind of see it differently. For the sex assault victim, they suffer their whole lives. And for the one that gets assaulted because we didn't bother to name the person we knew about, their lives are absolutely destroyed. So, yes, this is about whether or not we care about children. That's really what it's about.
Another question from the virtual space. This one for Emily from Amanda Vondras out in our virtual space. To what extent, question for Emily, to what extent do you think the low recidivism is because of the offender list?
I think that's not true because the recidivism rates were declining. The recidivism rates have remained constant. So there was low recidivism rates for sex offenses in studies done in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And a study in New Jersey that looked at the impact of Megan's Law showed the recidivism rates were constant before and after, and the sex offense rates were consistent before and after the implementation of Megan's Law. So these laws didn't create low recidivism rates. The recidivism rates were low before these laws.
But comment, that's a comment, Rossi, for me?
You know what would be really great is no recidivism. It's not persuasive to say that it's low, it's only 5%, or whatever it is. What the FBI tells you, as I said before, is many of these perpetrators have over 150 victims over the course of their lives. Nassar, again, is not unusual. You know what's different about Nassar? We had a judge that permitted kids that were outside of the statute of limitations to give victim impact statements. We had a judge that said, everybody get in here and look at him and tell him what he did to you. Yes, Nassar was in the context of a sex offender registry universe, and he was not subjected to it. You know why? Because nobody came forward and understood what they were seeing. So do sex offender registries work by themselves? Absolutely not. Are they a tool that is to be added on to all of our other tools to try to end this pandemic? It seems to me they have to be.
Next question from the floor.
Hi, how would either of you address the idea that the sex offender registry violates the rights of privacy?
I guess that question is directed to you, Marcy, more as a challenge. Right to sex offender registry.
I think it does.
Violates the right to privacy.
I think you gave up your privacy the day you sexually assaulted a child on that issue. And that's what the courts have said.
But, you know, many people on the registry assaulted adults also, but
Well, I'm not talking about adults, am I? I'm only talking about children.
Oh. No sex offender rate for people who assault adults sexually? Marcy, is that a clarification?
No, I'm not saying we shouldn't have them. I'm just saying that
the
strongest argument is by far the children.
Okay, but what about the privacy of those who have assaulted adults? They've forfeited that right also?
There is no such right. That's a made-up right that the courts have not identified.
Okay.
You know, it's very easy to talk about rights that don't exist, but they have to have been court-identified as part of the Constitution. That's not.
Thank you. Next question.
This question is for Emily. Why is prison a preferred punishment above a sex offender registry? Like, why is that punishment okay, and isn't murder or arson or any other violent felonies, aren't they public? Can you hide that if you've gone to prison for murder?
No, I don't think prison is above that. It's just that people on registries are people who've already served their time, so they've gone to prison already. Mm-hmm. Does that answer your question?
Sure. Next question.
Hi, my question is for Marcy. So I know Emily talked about this a little bit, but there's lots of residency laws around people who are convicted of sex offenses. In New York State, for example, we have a 1,000-foot law. I was wondering if you could speak on how that law protects children, in your opinion, when I know the research doesn't quite play this out. And I secondly would ask, I know you're not talking about adults here, but do you think that the residency requirements should be applied to adults, as they are in New York State, for people who are level 3 sex offenders, regardless of whether the underlying crime involved a child?
Could you summarize that question, Marcy, before you answer it?
Sure.
It's a good, complex question, but summarize it for the audience makes sure the question is focused.
Sure. So the resident, the question is separate from registration. It's about residency requirements that have been piling on, which have basically driven, in for example, in Miami, all of the sex offenders are under one bridge. It's my view that the residency restrictions are ridiculous. They make absolutely no sense. But they're different from a registration. What the residency requirements say is you can't live here or you can't live there. You know, even if you don't live there, you might still walk by a school. So I don't think they're very effective. They're also much more likely to be unconstitutional.
So there should be no residency restrictions or requirements on sex offenders?
So long as we have a decent registration, I think that the residency is not necessary.
I see.
Or effective.
Yes. Comment from you, Emily?
I'd agree the residency restrictions are bad laws, but they're part of the scheme.
We have a moment of harmony between the two debaters, but they still do seem to disagree on the resolution. Next question from the floor.
Thank you. Hi. I think you mentioned 900,000 people were currently on the registered sex offender list. What percentage of those people are people like Larry Nassar versus Romeo and Juliet situations?
There's a factual question. Perhaps you can deal with it, Emily. Would you know?
Well,
make the distinction for the audience.
I will say 95% of the people who are on the registry are first-time offenders, so they don't have a history of prior sex offense convictions.
I see.
But
that's about all you know in terms of the breakdown offhand, the breakdown of the Romeo, the younger people versus the older
right.
people.
Right. People under 30 are overrepresented. African-American men are overrepresented.
How about people under 18?
How many? Well, it's not clear how many people under 18 are on the public registry, but we do know that about a quarter to a third of those who sexually abuse children are children themselves. Mm-hmm. That's not to say they're all on the registry. Some states don't put children on the registry. Some states do. In some states, there's children as young as 9 on public registries.
Do you want to comment, Marcy?
Let's just look at the numbers. In a country that has, about 325 million people, and sex offenders run about 2.1 to 2.5% of the population, 900,000 is a small number. Mm-hmm. It sounds big by itself, but for the actual likelihood of existing sex offenders, there are a whole lot that are not being reported and aren't out there.
See. Next question.
You've mentioned that the registry is just a tool, and I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how that works in conjunction with other things, like, for example, statute of limitation reform, or what other tools work together to make the registry more effective.
Question for you, Marcy.
It's my view that by far the most important thing that we have to do to figure out who our pedophiles are is through statute of limitations reform. The vast majority of the United States until recently has cut the victims out. So by the time they're ready, they don't get to name anybody. And if they do name someone and they're not in statute, they get sued for defamation. And that happens again and again and again. So it's my view that's the baseline. Once we let the victims come forward when they're ready and they can name the perpetrators, and when they name them, if the criminal statute of limitations hasn't expired, they can be sent to jail. That's the best possible universe. Everything else we're doing, mandated reporting, these kinds of registries, background check requirements, all of these are buttresses. But so long as we shut victims out of the court system, we're just not going to know what we need to know about child sex abusers.
Comment from you, Emily? Or no, okay. Next question.
Well, I have a couple of questions in there for Marcy. The first one I have is, you had said something about that children didn't have a lobby, and first I'd like to know what you base that on, what study you base that on. I personally have met lobbyists in different states. The one that I'm from, they have a strong lobby, and I know other states do, that are there to testify, are there to tell stories. But they do have a lobby.
What do you mean by a lobby, and what's your second question?
The other thing was that they do have a lobby, and some kids just want, because we've had sexual abuse in our family, and they just want to move on. They don't want to relive it, you know, forever. And so I'd like to know where you got the study saying that they didn't have a lobby, because they are, and they're very effective, and there are.
Your question is where do you get the
where
idea?
Where did she get the statement that she made about they didn't have a lobby?
The children don't have a lobby. You want a question about that?
Yes. A lobby. Okay.
Thank you for your question. Would you address it, Marcy?
So let me rephrase it. They have a powerless lobby. I completely disagree, and I deal with these issues in all 50 states. The ability of children's issues to get to the forefront for the vast majority of our state legislatures and for our federal system, it's extraordinarily difficult. It's so difficult. It's so much easier to get state legislators to pay attention to taxes or to bringing business into the state or anything else that interests an adult. So while we do have testimony by children frequently, maybe, or at least former child victims, their issues are the easiest issues to table. And that's just the reality. And anybody who works in the child protection universe, like I do, will tell you they're about the least powerful in the Capitol. They are nothing compared to pharma, insurance, and the Catholic bishops.
Any comments from you, Emily? No. Okay. A question from virtual space for Marcy. A question from Pat Gelmond in the virtual space. Should there be any way to remove oneself from the registry? Should there be any way for somebody to be able to remove him or self or herself from the registry?
Once we have the kind of treatment and proof that someone is not going to reoffend, of course. We don't have that yet. And so I'm more than willing to protect the child from the person who has already sexually assaulted another child. That's what we're talking about.
Comment, Emily, or no?
Well, we know low-risk offenders have very low rates of reoffense, right? And even the highest-risk offenders, after 15 years, there's almost no risk of reoffense. So why wouldn't you want to at least let people get off the registry, even without any treatment? We know that after 15 years, people who commit sex offenses desist.
That's ridiculous.
It's not that ridiculous.
That is so okay. Untrue.
That's not true.
We clearly have a moment of disharmony.
Okay, wait, please.
They don't age out. They do not age out.
They do. A meta-analysis of 21 studies by Carl Hansen showed across the board there is desistance, even for the highest risk. The lowest risk right away have a 1 to 5% chance of recidivism. I'm not assuming. It's a meta-analysis. I didn't do it. It's by Carl Hansen. It was published in 2014.
Whoa. You're assuming.
Okay, whoever started
that
is going to
be clear. This is data. I'm not assuming anything.
No, and I'm giving you data.
Carl Hansen's meta-analysis in 2014.
Social scientists will tell you that pedophiles do not stop preying on children. Child pornographers do not stop just because they get older.
First of all, I'm talking about people convicted of sex offenses. You can call them whatever you want. These are human beings who are convicted of sex offenses, and their rate of their recidivism rates decline steadily over time. By 15 years, even the highest risk have a very, very low risk of reoffense, and that
but
is a fact.
They do have a risk of reoffense.
That's true.
They do.
Okay,
they do.
We had a moment of disharmony between the two debaters, which is what we do in a debate. So next question from the floor.
Yes, this question is for both of you. Isn't one of the problems with the registry that, as Emily mentioned earlier, African-Americans are overrepresented, indigent people are overrepresented, really the powerless in society, they're the ones who can't afford good lawyers, who are often coerced into pleading guilty when the charges aren't strong, whereas the Larry Nassars of the world, you know, the reason they get away with it time and time again is because they're powerful men supported and shielded by powerful institutions.
So that's your question. Comment on the statement, please, Marcy or Emily. Do you want to comment, Marcy?
I would agree that those without power are overrepresented on the registry and in all areas of the criminal justice system.
The powerful are sexually abusing at the same rates as the powerless. We are in the Me Too movement. Harvey Weinstein was taken down. Larry Nassar was taken down. Priests have been repeatedly taken down. That will change. That percentage will change. We didn't want to think that our most powerful and important men were actually doing horrible things to children or anybody else. But it turns out many of them are. So that statistic is a bleep in history. It will change. Nassar is now in jail. His ilk will be in jail just as much.
Thank you. Next question from the floor.
Hi. So now that child porn is more easily available through the internet and authorities are actively seeking to convict people that are viewing child porn online and adding them to the registry, what effect has this had on finding offenders before they can prey on children and ultimately reducing child molestation across the country?
Did you get the question? Why don't you summarize the question as you understand it and answer it?
because child porn is readily available on the internet, the FBI can get people who are looking at child porn before they engage in a contact offense? I haven't seen any data that shows that, but I have seen a lot of evidence that a lot of people are getting really long triple-digit prison terms for viewing child pornography. Including people who are intellectually and developmentally disabled with no history of a contact offense.
What would be your prison term for somebody caught viewing child pornography, Emily?
My prison term?
What prison term would you want to impose on that kind of person?
I mean, they should go to prison. I don't know. I'm not a lawyer, okay. And I don't feel comfortable making a sentencing decision, but I think they should be punished.
Comment
absolutely.
From you, Marcy?
I don't think they should be killed.
Any comment from you, Marcy, on the question?
The best recent studies show that child pornography is a gateway to child sex assault. And so if you can stop someone at the pornography level, you have a shot at stopping some of the sex assault. That's just the science that's out there.
Well, this is Michael Cito, who's the most eminent child pornography researcher. He says that there's a lot of evidence that there are people who do view child pornography, and it, for whatever reason, maybe it's an outlet, maybe they're not comfortable committing a contact offense, but there's a lot of evidence that it doesn't directly lead to a contact offense. In the same way, smoking pot doesn't lead to heroin use. It's not causal. There is no evidence that looking, at least according
this
to Michael
is,
Cito,
okay,
and some, I'm not an expert in this area, but this is
right,
what the studies
not.
Show.
With all due respect, with
that's
all due
very
respect,
rude.
You can't sit over there and say that you have studies. And when I tell you what the scientists say, the child
but Michael
traumatologists
Cito is
say,
the person who
no,
studies
no, there isn't
this.
One person in the child traumatology field.
No, in child
what
pornography.
What AFSAC will tell you, which is the leading group in the country on this issue, is that it definitely normalizes it. It makes it much more likely that sex assault will occur, number one. Number two, the harm that is done by child pornography to children is so severe because even if they are not individually sexually assaulted, they live their lives in fear that their image is being viewed all over the world. It turns out to be even more problematic than a one-time rape, believe it or not. So child pornography is a really, really serious problem. And the studies are showing that it's a gateway, that it is not just someone having fun for the afternoon.
Next question from the floor.
When I first read the question earlier, the question was not about child pornography. It wasn't about children. It was about should people be put on the registry for life. So in hearing the comments about this, this has been focused on a linear way away from the overall purpose of the registry. So my question is, in thinking about myself as a person of color, has the registry been used as a tool to negatively impact people of color? And I have cases where it was an individual, a white college athlete who raped a woman, assaulted a woman, and the judge wrote a letter, all kind of people wrote a letter, this person got off. And then it was a similar case where a person of color was accused of an act and got 15 years to life. So is this registry used as a tool to negatively impact people without power?
I think that's a question directed to you, Marcy.
No, I think it's Emily. Uh-huh.
Okay.
I think that's Emily's question.
Okay, that's Emily's question. Emily,
yes,
take
there
it.
Is evidence that racial minorities are overrepresented on the registry and in all areas of the criminal justice system, including sex offense prosecutions. There are sentencing disparities, racial disparities in sentencing across the board.
But what we are seeing is a reduction in the willingness of anyone to go to bat for the sex assaulter, right? That was just routine. That's what we did for our powerful people. So, yes, the disparity is absolutely wrong, but we're going in the direction where it just doesn't matter anymore. If you're the most powerful person in the world and you've sexually assaulted someone, you are going to be in trouble. And so it seems to me the Me Too movement has moved us into much better territory on that very issue.
This will have to be our last question. Last question from the floor before we get to the summations. So give us your question, please.
Yes. So since it's been mentioned that this is about the sex, the registry in general, and not just about children. I think the question is, Marcy, do you feel that despite everything that you said with regards to who you don't want to be on the registry, right? So Juliet and Romeo and Juliet cases and the like, and the fact that, like you said, the fact where they live doesn't matter because they can do it anywhere. And to your point that if someone's hiring that person as a coach or so on, if they've already been convicted, which would be the only case that they would be on the registry, then they should do that in the checkup and see if they have a court case against them, if they've been convicted of a crime. They don't need to be on a registry for them to know that. So do you still believe that the registry should stay intact as it is now, even though it's not protecting all of these cases, including Nassar, which is a case that you keep bringing up, where really the problem there is perhaps more an issue of not punishing the people who saw and said nothing?
I think that you in that statement was you, Marcy. So could you comment? do you want to briefly summarize sure. the argument you've been heard right. As you understand it? Before you
so I'm more than happy to agree that children should not be on the registry because they're treatable. We do know that as a matter of science. We know that it's possible to turn them around, and they will not become recidivists. We don't have the same kind of comfort with older people. So is the registry something that we need? I do think we continue to need it. Is it unfortunate that some people are on the registry and have terrible lives? Yes. But for those who have committed sexual assault, it is a way of preventing it from happening to other people. So, yes, I will stand by it for now. If we find the therapy, let's go for it.
Why don't you hold, if you want to comment, Emily, why don't you hold that for your summation, which will come up in a moment. Those who didn't get a chance to ask your questions, I'm sure the debaters will be hanging out at the bar afterwards, and you'll get a chance to chat with them. So we're going to have the summations. Emily, please come to the podium and give us your summation.
Registrations, 20 years after registries blanketed our country, there's a whole lot more evidence in. I know Marcy disagrees with this, but there is no rigorous, credible evidence that the registry includes public safety. And it's not just that we disagree, this is what the data shows. There's no rigorous and credible evidence that the registry decreases recidivism. Registries cost us so much money, hundreds of millions of dollars in state and federal funds. These solid figures are very hard to come by. Recently, a study in California found that it spends $65 million a year, and that state has 1/8 of the total registrants in the country. There's another really important cost that's hard to quantify, but we have to consider the damage done to those on the registry. For starters, that's damaged their livelihood as well as their future prospects. We're all concerned with children and their welfare, but all the metrics of crime are going down. The overwhelming number of sex offenses against children are committed by first-timers and someone known to the victim, not by a registrant. The long and short, there's a very strong case to be made against the registry. What would happen if it disappeared? All the other laws, all the other criminal laws remain in place. There are increased penalties for repeat offenses. Recidivism in sex offense cases has been wildly exaggerated. We know this. It should be handled just like other offenses. It's not low because of the registry. A 2008 study in New Jersey found it had no effect on recidivism or first-time sex offenses or on reducing the number of victims. The rates were the same for a decade before and a decade after Megan's Law. The registry repunishes people who have already paid a price and been punished. And the registry has such harsh impacts that it's a setup for failure. We all want to protect the children, but we have to do it in a way that's based on facts, not fear, and we can't pander to emotion. We have to be smart, and we have to do the right thing. Thank you so much.
Summation from Marcy. Take it away.
So I believe in Emily's rush to eliminate the registries. What she's doing is she's sacrificing the children. It's not zero recidivism. It's significant recidivism. And if you have a circumstance, scientifically, as we know from the experts,
where many perpetrators have more than one victim, the notion that you must repeatedly convict them in order to solve the problem means that we're just going to sacrifice more children. And why is that? The vast majority of sex assault and sex offenses are not prosecuted. Why? Because our prosecutors are elected officials. They want to have winning records. You need evidence beyond a reasonable doubt to convict someone. The vast majority of sex assault, especially of children, is never prosecuted. That means the vast majority never makes it onto a registration. That's why the number is 900,000, not the actual percentage it would be of 325 million people here. I understand the concern about adults. I hear it all the time. I understand that we have to be deeply concerned about an adult who's going to lose his livelihood if, in fact, someone finds out that he sexually abused a child. But I'm not willing to sacrifice all of those children in a rush to make sure that the adults who sexually assaulted the child we know about. So what do we need to do here? We need to actually look to science to develop, is it possible to treat someone who is the person who abused 5 children, 10 children, 15 children? Let me just close by telling you about a call I got yesterday. I got a call from a family out in Illinois, and they told me that they wanted to know what to do because there was someone in their community who was sexually offending children. I said, well, you have to go to the authorities. And they said, well, they went to the authorities, but it wasn't enough. So, well, how do you know that he's a sex offender if the police won't investigate? And their answer was that he was on the sex offender registry in another state. God bless those people that they know to protect their children. I fear the world that Emily would like you to live in where we don't identify the perpetrators before we're capable of treating them. Thank you.
Jane, you're opening the app to cast the final vote on the resolution. All laws requiring people to register as sex offenders should be abolished. You can vote for, against, or still undecided on the resolution. Please do so. Jane will be watching the voting. People in the virtual space will be voting. People in our physical space will be voting. And she will shortly be closing the voting and giving me the results. Meanwhile, let me again announce that next Monday, March 19th, we're going to have clearly a related debate on this topic. We cordially invite our debaters to return. You both get free tickets to the next month's event. Stony Brook University sociology professor Michael Kimmel will defend the resolution, "There is a rape culture on college campuses that creates an unsafe environment for female students," against journalist Kathy Young, author of "The Injustice of the Rape Culture Theory." On Monday, April 16th, Mises Institute senior fellow Robert Murphy will defend the resolution, "Fractional reserve banking poses a threat to the stability of market economies," against George Selgin, director of the Cato Institute's Center for Monetary and Financial Alternatives. On Monday, May 14th, Brian Kaplan, George Mason University economist and author of the forthcoming book, "The Case Against Education," no longer forthcoming. In fact, the book has been published, "The Case Against Education," will defend the resolution, "All government support of higher education should be abolished," against Edward Glaser, professor of economics at Harvard University. And then on Monday, July 2nd, that's the event that is quickly selling out, so buy your tickets this evening. July 2nd is that event on Bitcoin with Eric Voorhees and Peter Schiff. But prior to July 2nd, we will have our Monday, June 11th debate, which I know will also be a popular one. Georgetown Law Professor Randy Barnett will defend the resolution, "U.S. the U.S. Constitution should be interpreted and applied according to the original meaning communicated to the public by the words of the text, against Cornell Law Professor Michael Dorf. Jane, where do we stand on the voting? Do you want to, ready to report the results? Oh my gosh, okay. Please come to the stage. Okay, voting yes on the resolution in the initial phase, we got, was 39% of the vote voted yes. Post, it climbed to 72%. That's a 33% climb. So that's the number to beat. Marcy had, the noes had 22% and fell a bit, therefore did not match the 33%. Therefore, the Tootsie Roll goes to Emily. Congratulations.